Good morning, planet Earth. Good morning to you gentle folk out there wondering about the nature of reality. Good morning to you seekers and travelers of the mind space peering deeply into the center of the cosmos. Good morning to the people with X-ray eyes. Good morning to those of you who see so deep you are fearful. Good morning. It is October the 28th, 2024. It's right around 4 a.m., if you can believe it, here on the Olympic Peninsula, and this is the continuing series. The continuing ongoing series of my manifesto, Boblimp Doc towards a new lurching. But it's Monday morning, and I don't think anybody's happy about that. This is chapter 4, White Trash, Hyper-Racism, and the Paul Harvey Effect. If I were the devil, if I were the Prince of Darkness, I'd want to engulf the whole world in darkness. And I'd have a third of its real estate and four-fifths of its population, but I wouldn't be happy until I had seized the ripest apple on the tree, thee. So I'd set about, however necessary, to take over the United States. I'd subvert churches first. I'd begin with a campaign of whispers. With the wisdom of a serpent, I would whisper to you as I whispered to Eve, do as you please. To the young, I would whisper that the Bible is a myth. I would convince them that men created God instead of the other way around. I would confide that what's bad is good and what's good is square. And the old, I would teach to pray after me, O our Father, which art in Washington. And then I'd get organized. I'd educate authors on how to make lurid literature exciting so that anything else would appear dull and uninteresting. I'd threaten TV with dirtier movies and vice versa. I'd peddle narcotics to whom I could. I'd sell alcohol to ladies and gentlemen of distinction. I'd tranquilize the rest with pills. If I were the devil, I'd soon have families that war with themselves, churches at war with themselves, and nations at war with themselves until each in its turn was consumed. And with promises of higher ratings, I'd have mesmerizing media fanning the flames. If I were the devil, I'd encourage schools to refine young intellects but neglect to discipline emotions. Just let those run wild until before you knew it, you'd have to have drug-sniffing dogs and metal detectors at every schoolhouse door. Within a decade, I'd have prisons overflowing. I'd have judges promoting pornography. Soon, I could evict God from the courthouse, then from the schoolhouse, then from the houses of Congress. And in his own churches, I would substitute psychology for religion and deify science. I would lure priests and pastors into misusing boys and girls and church money. If I were the devil, I'd make the symbols of Easter an egg and the symbol of Christmas a bottle. If I were the devil, I'd take from those who have and give to those who want until I had killed the incentive of the ambitious. And what do you bet I could get the whole states to promote gambling as a way to get rich? I would caution against extremes and hard work and patriotism and moral conduct. I would convince the young that marriage is old-fashioned, that swinging is more fun, that what you see on TV is the way to be. And thus, I could undress you in public, and I could lure you into bed with diseases for which there is no cure. In other words, if I were the devil, I'd just keep on doing what he's doing. Paul Harvey. Good day. These words were spoken by Paul Harvey in 1965. Paul Harvey was born in 1918 during a time of great conflict. Paul Harvey died in 2009, a time of bullshit and pain. During his time on the stage, with tempered rage and wit to balance, he silenced critics with his wispy homespun perspectives and his Cadillac-style vibrations. Some say he invented that calm talk drip, that afternoon chat trip, that voice over AM radio that soothed you as you yelled about gas prices and urinated on pictures of Jimmy Carter. One might contend that the Paul Harvey effect is about this new way he invented for engaging with high-fidelity listeners, but this is misleading. Paul's dark craft swerved further under wraps as Case Monkeys and other Dorbin hustlers moved west from Philly. Paul was born in Oklahoma, the son of a cop. His dad was killed by robbers in 1921. Paul made radios as a kid and attended standard public schools. Paul served in World War II and sailed the ocean blue. He met thieves and pirates and wayward travelers. In 1944, he met Jorgen Toll, a Nazi defector and crystal meth manufacturer, and they got cooking. Paul moved to Chicago after World War II, where he and Jorgen set up their first meth factory in a cavernous sewer below the Field Museum. Paul used his cover as a radio guy to make connections in the then-growing drive-time radio world. In that world, you have helicopter pilots and sky warriors and weathermen and pimp lords, and they all want meth. This is not known to many, of course, and is denied by most as I drink my sacred coffee, so you never know, right? The Central Intelligence Agency was brand new back then, and Alan Dulles wanted to inject LSD into the scrotum sacks of priests and nuns and the Pope. Paul worked with the CIA to get the U.S. Air Force home cook up and running for meth pills. Them F-86 pilots in the Korean theater did better against the MiG-15s if they had some meth. As it happens, the same formulation goes into ADHD drugs today. In 1951, ABC News debuted Paul as their noontime lunch guy. He'd speak words to those animals, working their hours in coyote mills and ash factories, and thereby maintain a level of peace and control over the teeming masses, the masses of the future. Baby boomers, still kids, would eat chocolate ho-hos and chuckle, not knowing the secrets, barely understanding the rumors. Paul was a groomer. He was a loomer. He loomed large over Americana as it grinded out babies and nukes and cars. Paul was an avid pilot and was responsible for distributing the meth that he and Jorgen cooked each week. Sometimes Jorgen would come along for the ride. One trip in 1958, they were delivering meth to Stugsville, Arkansas, and a young man, Bill Clinton, made $50 a day setting up landing strips with flashlights and bonfires, guiding into planes to drop the meth and the weed and the coke and the various trafficked men, women, and children for torture factories in L.A. and New York City. Jorgen and Bill became good friends and later facilitated the coke pipelines in Reagan's America, ensuring the flow for the burgeoning crack epidemic. At one point, the Bush family bought nearly half of all Paul's weekly batch, and this troubled Jorgen. But Jorgen, as a former Nazi, understood the lust for power and its synergy with meth-style living. In 1965, after 20 years of continuous meth use, Paul had a psychotic break. He began talking in riddles, and eventually his Paul Harvey effect was felt. During a broadcast in 1965, he urged on the true race to hold back against the dusky masses, and Jorgen smiled. Take down that angry black scar. You sit at the bars drinking watermelon cider, eating barbecue pie. Your hate is too late, my friends, because the true race never ends, and our white power glows, our white powder flows, and man will stand tall soon when we let go of tired sorrow. July the 6th, 1965. This radio tirade enraged Black America. General Hutu Bamgabi of the East L.A. Gondolord spoke out against Paul and demanded immediate street action and gutter-style violence. A few weeks later, Watts was in flames. L.A. was groaning under its weight. 500 years of oppression, the Middle Passage, all kinds of L.A. cop sideways bullshit, and people were pissed. You see, Jorgen Toll was Danish. Jorgen knew hate screeching and race ranting. He grew up in Copenhagen. Jorgen felt the pathetic rush as the vitamin D deficient prance around in funny costumes. Hitler recruited Jorgen in 1934 after a tasting party at the annual Full Society Soiree and Sex Banquet. Hitler knew the Danes had the darkest spirits and could reveal the twisting ways of physics and interracial love affairs. You see, Hitler was in love with a young woman named Deborah Hastings. Deborah had escaped Oklahoma after the Tulsa race massacres of 1921, the same period of time when Paul's dad was killed. Deborah had been living it up in Berlin, and at that time very few cared about her dark skin. Deborah was African-American, sweet and smart. She was chesty and had smiles. When she hugged Hitler, Adolf forgot about his plan and his pain. Adolf forgot about his failure. He forgot about his oaths of revenge. He forgot about his failed career painting postcards. He just saw her bathed in her light. But Hitler was leading the Aryan race towards totalistic victory against the Gankenbrood and the other lost forces of Mistress Vrom of beef torpedo fame. Hitler had promised racial purity, but he only knew one thing when he looked into Deborah's eyes, that he loved her, that he wanted to plant pretty little babies in her. When Hitler tried Jorgen's meth, this opened up conversations about 24-hour military operations and dive bomber Stukas and all kinds of things that meth heads talk about when they're high. Jorgen, what can I do about this love? You must free her and remember brave Germany. But I can't stop loving her. You will. You will, Hitler. If you want my meth. Now, years later, Hitler defeated, Paul meets Deborah and falls in love too. A fiery 1960s meth-fueled romp through the dungeon keeps of old America. Deborah was older than Paul, but she had experience with love squeezing and body juice sharing. Paul would go down on her like some ancient dirty diver, swimming for that pearl in her onyx soup. All of this to say that Jorgen did not fancy this at all, and he was going to stop it again because he secretly loved Deborah too. Fuck, this is sad. This was a love triangle that stretched across time, because unknown to Paul Harvey and his meth freak friend Jorgen, Hitler was not dead. In April 1945, as part of a secret Nazi experiment with relativistic effects, Hitler was transported 20 years into the future to Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. The device, or bell, was a hyperchamber utilizing dual plasmatics, EMF in immersion with quadraphonic sound and sexy results. The device glowed before their eyes as Hitler slipped 2 decades beyond the war and all of its terror. Hitler showed up in 1965 and was experimented on by the CIA. His arms were ripped off and then sewn back on again. He had roach gelatin injected into his skull. Cobra venom was put into his food and his testicles. Hitler spent months in one MK Ultra experiment after another. being jabbed and isolated. He had loud noises at high decibel levels directed into his ears, at his eardrums. He had sulfuric acid put into his spine. But in 1969, Hitler escaped, and after a few months of wandering America, he ended up in Chicago, at Rogers Cabaret in Boys Town. And it gets more sordid. Because Paul was with Deborah at Hoogley's off of Durgan Street in December 1969. They were at a Christmas party being hosted by Barbara Streisand when Hitler and Jorgen showed up. They were both super drunk and super belligerent. It got saucy. Hitler, filled with cocaine and whiskey and rage, grabbed Deborah by the arm and shouted, "You're going with me," but she didn't want to. Paul was none too happy either. Paul was carrying a switchblade and pulled it. He shoved that knife deep into Hitler's chest and the blood sprayed all over the club as the Teagley boys and late night shoppers went running back home to Evanston to play daddy again. Jorgen stood by and just watched these beasts go at it. Then he moved closer to Deborah as the fight turned to madness. "Hey, baby," Jorgen said. "Jorgen, you bastard!" Deborah slapped him across the face. "Baby, I know I'm..." "Stop right there! You tore me away from my first love! You got Hitler addicted to crank and racism and setting shit on fire! Fuck you, Jorgen!" Deborah walked away. She was tired of their busted-up minds. The bar shut down, and it was Hitler and Paul Harvey and Jorgen the Dane alone, sharing a booth in the darkness, drinking stale whiskey and smoking damp cigarettes. Hitler got real silent, with toilet paper shoved into the hole in his chest, but then after several minutes he mumbled, "What did I do it for? The war, the death, the hate." It was at that moment that Paul had a revelation. Paul got on a plane the very next morning. He was heading to California to meet with his friend Ronald Reagan, the governor of the state. Paul went directly to Reagan's compound in Pasadena, where Reagan kept Mexican slave girls and ran a nightclub for the militarists and pederasts of L.A. It was a skeevy place filled with those swollen lechers that are typically found near the sleazy wharfs of San Francisco. Paul was shocked by the blood shakes and the long pig pizza. Reagan brought Paul to his secret room, a special office for eldritch rites and experiments on French bulldogs and other kinds of Masonic activities. They talked for hours, and then Paul went back to his hotel. On the way back to his hotel, Paul was run off the road by the Manson family and taken back to Spahn Ranch. Charles sang songs for Paul, and they shared ideas about black people and Jews and Danes and the Beach Boys. It was within this kiln of awareness that Paul's mind baked. Paul had been pressed to the ultimate point of ripping, and he had a vision. This is a fragment of what he told Charles Manson. If God arrived covered in ants, morbidly saccharine, like the ancient burly beasts, if God came back for a lightning attack, taking with him the sinners, taking with him the slackers, he'd have backers like General Westmoreland. We could cave rape the Viet Cong, but our blood merchant fantasy soon ends. Our friends abandon us to the silk parlor for hours for love. The steam fills every crack. And we're done with Charlie Swift. And we're through trying. This is a long-winded way of saying the Paul Harvey effect was to spread meth and get bikers addicted. The bikers listened to Paul and Hitler and Jorgen and Chuck and were infected with a mind virus that spread. This led to easy payday loan businesses being opened up in many cities in the poorest parts of town, and later led to the strategic land purchases for buildings convenient to Planned Parenthood. The virus of racism went everywhere, into books and crooks and old crones baking coffee peach scones and making their bones off a heroin cake. All the nation caught fire, and racism led to meta-racism, and meta-racism led to critical race theory, and that led to BLM Antifa and Chop Chaz and Lord Raz making a gable closet of loose women with big tits. You don't know because no one ever told you. Hyper-racism is the acknowledgement that the people, all the people, everybody are white trash, even if their skin color is black, yellow, green, white, blue. I don't give a fuck. We don't care. We are all the same meat pie. Paul Harvey doomed us. We didn't come this far because we're made of sugar candy. Once upon a time, we elbowed our way onto and across this continent by giving smallpox-infected blankets to Native Americans. That was biological warfare, and we used every other weapon we could get our hands on to grab this land from whomever. And we grew prosperous. And yes, we greased the skids with the sweat of slaves. So it goes with most great states, which, feeling guilty about their savage past, eventually civilize themselves out of business and wind up invaded and ultimately dominated by the lean, hungry up-and-coming who are not made of sugar candy. Paul Harvey said this on June the 23rd, 2005. Good day.